It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
Heavy fighting takes more than 20 lives in Libya's eastern city of Benghazi. The U.S. expresses renewed concern over Sudanese woman facing death for apostasy. I'm Victor Beatty reporting from Washington. Heavy fighting between Islamists and a renegade general has killed at least 20 people and wounded more than 80 in the eastern Libyan city Benghazi. Reporter Edward Uranian has the story.
The clashes reportedly began when Ansar al-Sharia militiamen attacked the Libyan Special Forces battalion base with rockets and mortars, inflicting casualties. The Libyan military joint operations spokesman Ibrahim Shara says the militia attacked the army's Al-Sa'ika Battalion 21 base. He says that Ansar al-Sharia militia vehicles on patrol opened fire on the special forces base, to which army forces responded with their own fire. He says that after 3 hours of fighting, Libyan army warplanes entered the fray to relieve forces on the ground. The Libyan Air Force, which has sworn loyalty to former army Chief of Staff Khalifa Haftar, has bombed Islamist militia bases in Benghazi a number of times during the past week. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Meanwhile, Libya's latest government, headed by Ahmed Maitik, announced Monday it had taken office, despite apparent refusal by the cabinet of former Prime Minister Abdullah El-Thani to leave power. Mr. Maitik is Libya's fifth prime minister since Muammar Gaddafi was ousted in 2011. He is expected to lead a short transitional period until legislative elections to be held June 25th, when a new parliament will convene and form a new cabinet. The United States Monday repeated a concern about a Sudanese woman who has been sentenced to death for refusing to renounce her Christian faith and trying to assist with their cause. U.S. spokesperson Jen Psaki said Monday U.S. embassy officials met with the American husband of Sudanese national Maryam Yahya Ibrahim.
We do have a Privacy Act waiver for Mr. Wani at this time, who I can confirm is a U.S. citizen, as has been reported. We have been engaged with him since June of 2013, so for the last year, and we've been in regular contact with him throughout the trial. Embassy officials most recently met with him on June 2nd, so that is today. And one of our top priorities, as all of you know, is the protection of U.S. citizens overseas, and our continued engagement with him and efforts to assist him as a U.S. citizen are indicative of that commitment.
Ms. Ibrahim, born a Christian to a Christian mother and a Muslim father, she was brought up as Christian after the father left the family. Under Sudanese law, children of Muslim fathers are considered Muslim. A tribal source quoted by the French press agency says at least 41 people killed in clashes between rival Sudanese clans over ownership of land being explored for oil in West Kordofan State. The source says at least 13 others seriously wounded in the fighting that raged through Sunday between the Zurug and Aulad Amran clans of the Misriya tribe. Fighting frequently breaks out among rival clans over grazing rights. New Malawian President Peter Mutharika was inaugurated on Monday after an election disputed by his predecessor, Joyce Banda. He told supporters at a Blantyre stadium he wanted to reconcile with the former president, whose demand for a new election was rejected by the nation's high court.
I was looking forward to shaking her hand and to bear their part. I still invite her to join me in developing this country. I come to her with an olive branch in my hand. Don't let it drop from my hand.
74-year-old Mr. Mutharika is brother of the late President Bingu Wa Mutharika, whose death in 2012 allowed Ms. Banda to ascend from vice president. The new leader still faces treason charges for allegedly planning a coup after his brother died. On Sunday, a spokesman for the president's Democratic People's Party told VOA he hopes the charges will die a natural death. He also said Mr. Mutharika could unveil a cabinet of mostly technocrats later this week. The new president is Malawi's fourth since the country became a multi-party democracy in 1994. In his inaugural remarks, the new Malawian leader indicated his intention to forge ties with new friends such as China, Brazil, India, South Africa, and Russia, while continuing traditional Western relationships. He said he's looking for new friends. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian police ban Bring Back Our Girls protests in the capital, Abuja.
The police is not banning these protests out of bad faith. We have reports that some Muslims are trying to hijack the good thing these people are doing, and that is why we said for now, let's have a stop on this protest.
Attorney Daniel is the spokeswoman for the Nigerian Federal Capital Territory Police. The governor of Borno State, hotbed for Boko Haram, vows to fight the Islamist militants. Civil society groups say they are disappointed by former Malawi President Joyce Banda's refusal to peacefully hand over power. And South Sudan's president promises to restore peace to his war-torn country.
I am for peace and will always be for peace. I'm also for the development and progress of this nation, but will never stand for its destruction.
The South Sudan President Salva Kiir, and can Egypt's new president heal the country's economic woes? We'll get analysis. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Police in Nigeria have banned the daily protests in the capital, Abuja, intended to focus attention on the more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Islamist militants and pressure the government to rescue the girls. The demonstrators have vowed to challenge the ban in court. Attorney Daniel, spokeswoman for the Nigerian Federal Capital Territory Police, says the police did not ban the protests out of bad faith, but she tells me authorities have received intelligence that hooligans bent on causing trouble have been trying to hijack the protests.
First and foremost, I would like to see that the police, the FCT Police Command, have supported the protesters from day one, and we've always been with them throughout the period. But the police, in its wisdom, is not banning these protests out of bad faith. But because of an incident we had last week, where another group by the name Elisa Girl started pitching his tent too at the Unity Fountain, and there was almost a bloody clash there. That is one. Two, we have reports that some hoodlums are trying to hijack the good thing these people are doing to bring about problems, and we are looking at it from all the angles the normal security agent is supposed to look at it. And that is why we said for now, let's have a stop on this protest so that we can be able to monitor the activities of these hoodlums who would like to come and take over the protest which is being done in good light to foment trouble or bring about a crisis within the federal capital territory.
So what sort of reports do you have? What kind of people?
But you should know a security report is a security report. It's not a report for everybody's consumption. It's just for the security agency who gives this report to make good use of it. And that is why we're trying to forestall the breakdown of law and order based on our own report.
What do you say to those who say that perhaps the police are stopping the protesters because the protesters are trying to put pressure on the government to work a little harder to find the girls?
I want you to know that the federal government have been doing its very best. Security agents and agencies have not relented in their efforts at making sure we curb the excesses of these hoodlums and bring back these girls. So for anybody to say we are being used by government, I think that person is not being fair to us, because from day one, we've supported them and we've always been with them. But because of the security reasons, that is why we are trying to forestall a breakdown of law and order.
Can these protests take place in other cities besides Abuja?
Well, for now, what we have in our report is in Abuja, and we are the police command here in Abuja. And whatever actions we are taking it in the interest of the overall good of the citizens residing within the federal capital territory.
So the ban is effective as of what day?
Today is the day the pronouncement was made. And I can assure you, we agreed in good faith, and from today, becomes effective.
Altony Daniel is spokeswoman for the Nigeria Federal Capital Territory Police. She was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. The violent Islamic sect Boko Haram continues on its deadly path in northern Nigeria, holding more than 200 schoolgirls hostage and staging deadly attacks on cities and villages. The governor of the northeastern Nigerian state of Borno says the toll on his state is very high in terms of human lives and economic development. But he says he's determined to fight what he calls madmen terrifying the region. Zlatika Hoke has more.
Protests are held daily in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, where activists say they want more government action to free the girls from the clutches of Boko Haram.
I think of the girls and I think it could have been me. It could be my daughter. It could be my niece. It could be anybody. I think of the mothers and I think, you know what, we have to do this. Someone has to do it.
Borno Governor Kashim Shettima describes Boko Haram's leader, Abubakar Shekau, as insane.
I see him as a madman. In this age and time, somebody is talking of selling the girls into slavery. Can a reasonable, sensible person talk along that line? To me, he's a madman.
Shettima says he is determined to stop the terror caused by the marauding militants over the past 5 years. In the latest attack Sunday, a bomb believed to be planted by Boko Haram killed about 40 football fans in neighboring Adamawa state. Shettima says the group of about 1,500 fanatics is holding communities in the entire region ransom.
But I can assure you that they are not as many as people who are made out to believe. But because they are setting the pace of the war, they can wreak a lot of havoc. And that is precisely what they are doing. And they are not adhering to any international convention. They are just a bunch of raving lunatics.
The Borno governor says terror and violence has had a devastating impact on the state's economy. He says his state, which borders Niger, Chad, and Cameroon, is uniquely positioned for trade and investment. But the fighting has all but halted the development of the necessary infrastructure, especially the roads. He says the borders are closing and it will take time to repair Borno's image abroad.
It's very painful because Borno has been in the news for the wrong reasons for the past 5 years. Borno is the cradle of Islamic civilization in the West African sub-region. We have 1,200 years of recorded history. It's an insult to the integrity, to the history of the people of Borno.
The United States has sent military experts to help track more than 200 Nigerian girls still held by the Boko Haram militant group. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir has again promised to restore peace to his war-torn country. Addressing the opening session of the National Assembly on Monday, President Kiir said his priorities for the country include improving food security and rebuilding towns and villages destroyed by the ongoing conflict. Charlton Doki of VOA South Sudan in Focus program has more from Juba.
A police band played at the opening of the 2014 National Assembly, moments before President Kiir stepped to the podium. President Kiir decried the violence that has left thousands of people dead. He accused anti-government forces allied to former Vice President Riek Machar of violating the cessation of hostilities agreement signed in Addis Ababa last month.
I am for peace and will always be for peace, but not war. I'm also for the development and progress of this nation, but will never stand for its destruction. I promise to work with you to see South Sudan emerge strong economically and politically.
Mr. Kiir reiterated his commitment to unite South Sudanese. He called on the country's diverse communities to reconcile with one another and move forward as a united nation.
I humbly appeal to you all, my dear citizens, including our brothers and sisters, who are now in opposition, to forgive one another and come together in the spirit of true reconciliation and join hands to work in unity and understanding.
Mr. Kiir says he hopes to reach a political agreement and permanent ceasefire with the rebels and form an interim government in the coming months. He lashed out at unnamed leaders who he says are jostling for positions in a proposed interim government.
Some people do not want to follow the roadmap. What they see is the interim government. And when they talk about the interim government, they see themselves in the center, that they are the ones going to lead that interim government. I don't think that is the right outlook. Because if we do that you dissolve an elected government.
The president used his recently signed peace deal with Jonglei State's Pibor County rebel leader, David Yau Yau, to show that he can achieve peace in South Sudan. He urged legislators to endorse the agreement with Yau Yau as soon as possible. Mr. Kiir says he will rebuild the country and pointed to plans to start in December the long-awaited construction of the Fuller Rapids Hydro Project through a private-public partnership. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 3rd. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. A group of civil society and non-governmental organizations have expressed disappointment over former President Joyce Banda's refusal to hand over power peacefully to newly installed President Peter Mutharika. Billy Mayaya, a leading member of the Malawi civil society group, tells reporter Peter Clotty the former president's action shows a lack of leadership.
Well, first, let me just say, of course, Rigari, she was not obliged to go there and do any handovers. But, however, symbolically, it would have been very good for the country, for her just, you know, to go as a good gesture. I know, go and wish Professor Mutharika all the best and ceremoniously, you know, handover. But I think it would have symbolized quite a lot to the country, you know, to have showed unity. Basalisa, she has accepted this and is willing to move forward.
Basalisa, some civil society groups as well as non-governmental organization groups are saying that she should have shown leadership. She should have shown that Malawi is one, despite the fact that she is not constitutionally or legally forced to do that.
Well, of course, this is disappointing. As you're saying, it would have shown, it would have been a very good gesture, you know, unified the people. Of course, people are really unified, but it would have just consolidated that unity just to show that, okay, we are one, we are moving forward. But as I've said, she has done nothing wrong with Igali, so we can't really force her to do it, but it would have been better if she had done it.
As the Malawi Law Society, what are your expectations? I hear he was once a leading member of the Malawi Law Society. What are your expectations of him now that he's become president?
Well, of course, we expect that his government will follow the good tenets of, you know, the tenets of good governance, uphold the rule of law, that will be transparent and accountable to the people of Malawi. So that is our hope.
Salisa Kalemba is spokesperson for Malawi's Law Society. She spoke with reporter Peter Claude from the capital, Lilongwe. And on the report by Billy Mayaya.
Once popular with tourists, this market has mostly local shoppers a few days after.
During his campaign, Egypt's president-elect Abdel Fattah el-Sisi promised to heal the nation's ailing economy. And while many Egyptians have high hopes for newfound safety and prosperity, Mr. Sisi has called on Egyptians to make sacrifices, and he warned it will take years to reform the economy. But after 3 years of upheaval and no clear economic program, how much sacrifice can Egyptians make? Heather Murdoch has more for VOA from Cairo.
Once popular with tourists, this market has mostly local shoppers a few days after the presidential election. Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has been declared the winner. Pre-election pro-Sisi music still blares on the streets. Locals say the tourism industry, like others in Egypt, has flatlined. Ahmed Allah makes traditional boxes and games out of wood and mother of pearl. He says business has been bad since the 2011 revolution.
So actually, before the revolution, we was working very much, and it was many tourists in Egypt. But after the revolution, we feel very, very bad because the economy in Egypt, it's not only the tourists. Everything is damaged and everything's fall down.
Mr. Sisi's ideas to improve the economy were already in play before the votes were counted. The government plans to cut subsidies and reduce the national deficit. Mohammed Gad is a senior economic reporter at El Sharouk, a prominent Egyptian newspaper. He says the plan could backfire and a large cut in fuel subsidies could cause more unrest.
To some degree, this is an unprecedented move by the Egyptian state to deal with the subsidy. Without having a clear vision and alternative policies that would ease the economic pressure on both people in dire poverty and the middle class, it could bring down the social system.
Despite widespread poverty, the incoming president has called for sacrifices from the Egyptian people, suggesting they eat less food, walk more, and use less electricity to help their economy recover. He says he will significantly improve the economy and the security situation within 2 years.
The Egyptian people expected a lot of things. During two revolutions, they were aspiring for bread, freedom, social justice. The Egyptians wanted to live like this. I need to give them security, stability, and complete development.
But activists say the Egyptian public will not wait 2 years for change. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Cairo.
Burkina Faso and five other African countries will soon be receiving off-grid energy solutions as part of a new initiative from the Islamic Development Bank. During a conference in Dakar on Tuesday, the bank announced its Renewable Energy for Poverty Reduction Plan, which it says aims to raise around $175 million to provide solutions such as mini-grids. Shamuns Urema Tour, a leader of the initiative, tells Ricky Shryak the mini-grids will mix solar and diesel power to help off-grid communities gain access to electricity and alleviate poverty.
Well, on Tuesday, basically, we are launching this new flagship initiative of the Islamic Solidarity Fund for Development, which is the poverty reduction arm of the bank. And this program basically will bring electricity to the remote off-grid communities by installing small mini-grids, which will be essentially a hybrid of solar and diesel power generators. Essentially, the main source of electricity will be solar energy, but it will be backed up by diesel because in the night you don't have solar. And in case of emergency, you will have to have some backup in form of diesel generators.
In the next 3 years, the program will be implemented in 6 countries. Could you tell me which 6 countries they are?
Well, as a matter of fact, we have already starting, our technical teams have already visited Burkina Faso, which is the first country to benefit from the program. Now, as far as the other 5 countries are concerned, we have a lot of interest from the member countries, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. So as part of this conference, we are organizing an investment forum in which we are inviting proposals from a number of member countries. Essentially, it's open to all member countries to come up with proposals of projects that they would want the bank to finance. So those 5 countries are not firmed up yet.
What are some of the more precise ways access to energy can help alleviate poverty?
As a matter of fact, you see, in these remote off-grid communities, A, people don't have access to electricity. B, if they do have access to electricity, the means of producing that electricity are very expensive. People primarily rely on diesel generators. And the cost of diesel is extremely high in landlocked countries, in countries. Second of all, when people have access to electricity, they can use it for productive activities. And these productive activities, like small cottage industry shops, for example, storage of vaccines, the availability of electricity in the health clinics overnight in community centers, actually is useful for the community. But our focus is essentially bringing it to the people for productive purposes, for productive activities.
That was Shamuns Urema Tour, a senior portfolio management specialist at the Islamic Development Bank. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar. This month, fans from around the world will be heading to Brazil for football's FIFA World Cup. But as health reporter Art Times tells us, public health experts advise there could be more at risk than a disappointing result on the field.
Experts at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say travelers visiting Brazil may be exposed to a variety of health and safety risks. Dr. Joanna Gaines in the CDC's Geographic Medicine branch says there always are risks to health and safety while traveling, but she cautions that for those going to Brazil for the World Cup or the 2016 Olympics,
travelers who are attending special events like these may be at an increased risk.
In an online article published in the medical journal JAMA Internal Medicine, Gaines and her colleagues recommended vaccinations or preventive medicine for infectious diseases, including yellow fever and malaria. In other cases, travelers should be aware of steps they can take to avoid getting infected, for example, with dengue fever.
There's no medication or a vaccine to prevent it, so we really recommend that travelers are regularly using insect repellents, wearing long-sleeve clothing, wearing clothing that's been treated with insect repellent, and doing those types of active things that they can do to protect their health.
Travelers are urged to check with their doctor before going, says the article, and doctors should alert their patients to hazards ranging from bed bugs and sexually transmitted diseases to crime and traffic accidents.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. Uganda's Victoria University pipped Sudan's El Ahly Shandi by a solitary goal in the semifinals at the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's SECAFA Nile Basin Tournament in Khartoum, Sudan on Monday. Later, Kenya's AFC Leopards dismissed Burundi's Academie Chite 2-0 in the other semi-final. Elsewhere, hosts Germany and Cameroon play to a 2-2 draw in Mönchengladbach on Sunday. Today, Tuesday, African champions Nigeria encounter Greece in another FIFA World Cup build-up match in Chester Park, Philadelphia State in the United States of America. Meanwhile, Egypt amassed 44 gold, 16 silver and 29 bronze medals to top the medal table at the conclusion of the Africa Youth Olympic Games in Gaborone, Botswana over the weekend. South Africa is second with 41 gold, 25 silver and 27 bronze medals. Nigeria placed third with 19 gold, 10 silver and 12 bronze medals. Algeria was fourth, followed by Ethiopia, Tunisia, Kenya, Botswana, Morocco, while Namibia placed 10th overall. Mauritius was 11th, followed by Madagascar, Cameroon, Libya, Seychelles, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Senegal, Zimbabwe, Mali, Uganda, Chad, while Angola, along with Sao Tome and Principe, shared the 22nd spot. Ghana is 23rd, followed by Ivory Coast, Republic of Congo, Zambia, Equatorial Guinea, Mozambique, Malawi, Tanzania, Gabon, Sierra Leone, as Burundi and Cape Verde Islands shared the 33rd spot. 54 countries competed in 21 sports disciplines. In several disciplines, the 10-day event was a qualifier for the World Youth Olympics in Nanjing, China in August. Finally, in athletics, Kenyan Lucy Kabu Wangui clocked 15 minutes and 21 seconds to win the Freyhofer's 5-kilometer run for women in Albany, New York State in the United States of America over the weekend. Ethiopians Mamitu Daska and Afera Godfey completed the medal podium appearance. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Police in Nigeria have banned a protest in the capital, demanding that the government rescue more than 200 schoolgirls kidnapped by Islamist militants. Officials say the decision was made because of security reasons. And new Malawi President Peter Mutharika was inaugurated on Monday after an election that was disputed by his predecessor. That's it for this Tuesday, June 3rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stradek, as well as post-editor Mark Ouman, along with our engineer Jesse Brooks, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga.
Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.